Once again, thank you for the invitation to spend a wonderful week in Cambridge and to address such a diverse audience. Those of you present at my talk yesterday, as Dr. Walton just mentioned, heard me talk about an aspect of my work that deals primarily with cultural history in Europe. Tomorrow, those who are part of this crash group will be hearing about past work. And today, you will be hearing about work that is very much in progress. But it's still the same face, the same person. having said that, this is a really very much a draft of a project that will probably take quite some time to completion, and I certainly would welcome a lot of questions, criticism, and suggestions. On March 22, 2006, the world woke up to a bit of unusual news. One of the world's media giants, the New York Times, reported, had paid an estimated $1.5 million to a South African family in settlement of a claim of copyright infringement on The Lion Sleeps Tonight, a song featured in the movie and Broadway smash hit production The Lion King. Although it was not the first time that the song had been misappropriated, there had in fact been more than 200 cover versions prior to The Lion King. Under the provisions of the British Imperial Copyright Act of 1911, in force at the time when the original to The Lion Sleeps Tonight was written, the copyright to a work reverts to the author's estate 25 years after his or her death, a provision called reversionary interest. And since the composer of The Lion Sleeps Tonight had died in 1962, subsequent to 1987, all uses of the song The Lion Sleeps Tonight required to be authorized by his estate and should have accrued reversionary interest. Copyright violations are, of course, not uncommon in the music industry. Musicians sue other musicians for allegedly stealing parts of their material. Huge amounts of bootlegged CDs and cassettes change hands in the developing countries every day. And P2P file sharing continues unabated even after years of legal battle. It's been ruled illegal in numerous jurisdictions. Settlements such as the one reached in May 2006 are not out of the ordinary either, as they often save defendants much larger payments, not to mention a lot of negative publicity. What is unusual is the direction of the charges and the broader framework in which the case was argued. For the media giant is none other than Disney Enterprises, Inc., and The Lion King, one of the most successful Broadway productions in history, still playing to packed houses around the world. The South African plaintiffs, for their part, are the two surviving daughters of Solomon Linda, the composer of the original song substantial parts of The Lion Sleeps Tonight are said to be based on. Boobe, first released in 1939 on the Gallatone label and considered to be one of the foundations of a new genre of migrant performance, also called boobie. Unlike Disney shareholders, the Linda daughters lived in abject poverty, a third daughter having died of HIV/AIDS because she could not afford the medication that would have prolonged her life. For the first time in the history of the global music industry, a major suit was filed by a group of plaintiffs living on the periphery of the global economy, against one of the countries, one of the industry's giants, headquarters in the West, thus reversing a trend which Malawian American musician Masako Chipembere, reacting to the settlement, describes in these words: America's contributions are always recognized in Africa, but Africa's contributions are never recognized in America. So what are we dealing with here? The triumph of justice at long last? The victory of reason, markets, property rights, artist rights, or creativity? Of the third world even? Or is Disney's half-hearted acknowledgement of corporate wrongdoing rather a symptom of what John and Gene Komarov have aptly termed millennial capitalism? A world in which the experiential contradictions at the core of neoliberal capitalism produce desire and expectation on a global scale, while at the same time decreasing the certainty of work and the security of persons. Before I explore some of these questions in detail, a quick review of the songs in question might be useful. Now, here's a brief excerpt from The Lion Sleeps Tonight, as it features in Disney's The Lion King. Double click, right? Okay. Next example is The Lion Sleeps Tonight, the first major cover version of Linda's songs, authored by Hugo Peretti and George Weiss and recorded by The Tokens on the RCA label in 1961, a year before Solomon's death. Although prior to The Tokens, there had been other misappropriation of Mbube. The one you probably also would know is Wim Away by Pete Seeger and the Weavers, as well as recordings by South African icons Manhattan Brothers or Miriam Makeba. It was The Tokens recording that really broke the sound barrier, topping the charts for three consecutive weeks before the Beatles. The original recording of 1939, Solomon Linda.
We move on.
Now, I am not concerned here with the merits of the case per se, or not primarily. That is the question whether or not Disney had in fact misappropriated Linda's song. I think they did not, but that's not my main point. My concern is rather with the broader implications of the case for the ability of the law to limit the scope of meaning-making in the global cultural arena. And as such, this concern is embedded in or reflects or fueled by a widening debate in recent years about the increasingly aggressive role of intellectual property law in shaping concepts of authorship, creativity, and subjectivity in times of global cultural production. And my focus then is on the making of Solomon Linda's Mbube as original and hence property through a complex set of signifying practices involving intellectual property law, scholarly and popular discourse, and most importantly, musical performance itself. More particularly, I'm seeking to develop further several strands of argument that have shaped discourse about intellectual property and musical practice over the past two decades or so. First, I suggest that legal systems of intellectual property, usually portrayed as regimes of rights and obligations, do not exist in an autonomous sphere separate from an extra-legal social world in which claims are being generated, which then require legal resolutions. Here I join a small but influential group of legal scholars working within the field of critical legal studies, such as Rosemary Coombe, Surratt Austin, Jonathan Simon, and others, who reject this instrumentalist perspective. IP law, these scholars argue, plays a far more constitutive, universalizing role and often produces the very signs and symbols with which social differences are giving meaning in the first place. Second, expanding on this law as culture concept, as it is currently understood within critical legal studies, I propose that musical practice shares with the law a fundamental concern with normativity. The relationships between musicians, audiences, and the music industry, and frequently the way these are encoded within music itself, often appear to be more rule-like, canonical, and self-referential than the model of law underpinning legal scholarship, having a profound impact on, and in many ways even creating some of the law's taken-for-granted concepts of authorship, originality, and appropriation. Consequently, such practices also do not so much stand outside the law as in the majority of studies on music and intellectual property, which framed the relationship between the music industry and the law as that of two distinct realms, that is, as music and the law, then they are to be seen as law. The status of musical works as original creations and individual property, I argue, is not established through legal acts alone, such as through litigation, but as a result of the normative power of mass-mediated processes of duplication. Third, in the South African context, this approach is particularly useful because the attempts by the country's formerly disenfranchised majority to reclaim its land, urban spaces, natural resources, and above all, cultural heritage and memory, are often couched in dichotomous terms as part of a North-South conflict, a clash between the periphery and the center, or an episode in a larger anti-imperialist struggle. As a consequence, such attempts risk obscuring the complex and contradictory landscape of musical and cultural practice in which author-centered visions of intellectual property are far from being universally accepted. Liberally inspired cases such as Linda versus Disney not only fail to adequately reflect the implication of musical practice in the creation of power relationships, they are themselves deeply complicit with the South African state's attempt to reshape the country's cultural heritage along nationalist lines. There's three parts to my presentation. I will begin by providing briefly some general background on the lawsuit as it is described in an article written for WIPO magazine. That's the World Organization of Intellectual, the World International Property Organization, WIPO magazine, by litigating lawyer Owen Dean of the law firm of Spoor and Fisher. But while this text on the surface might be said to reflect the instrumentalist or music anthologue perspective, critiqued by critical legal studies, closer examination reveals that the propaganda campaign waged by Dean is shot through with culture. Based on a highly publicized story about Linda written by journalist Rian Malan for Rolling Stone magazine, the strategy constructs Linda as an author in the Western liberal sense of the term. At the same time, Linda's identity as author is being subsumed under larger, yet equally imagined identities such as Zulu culture or South Africa. Although advanced in the name of economic and cultural empowerment, this articulation of individual rights and cultural identity deploys a whole arsenal of Western stereotypes about African culture and music, thereby disavowing the very legal subject the strategy was meant to instantiate in the first place. From here, I move on in the second part of my presentation to the genealogy of Mbube as an original. The oxymoron genealogy of an original is meant to denote the opposite process from the one described by the majority of studies on intellectual property in music, which treat musical works, or songs, as privately owned objects whose mostly melodic core or substance is preserved in whatever recognizable form in subsequent covers. Reflecting intellectual property law's 18th and 19th century Western bias, this core is figured as fundamentally non-contingent. In contrast to this position, but also to a certain extent in departing from post-structuralist theories of authorship, I develop a theory of counterfeit in which cover versions are not mere copies, legitimate or illegitimate, but function as key vehicles in the production of normative, albeit cultural and historically contingent, concepts of musical substance, authority, and ownership. By analyzing what remains the most influential counterfeit version of Mbube, The Lion Sleeps Tonight by the Tokens that you just heard, I will show that the substance of Linda's 1939 recording is an ex post facto attribution made possible by numerous layers of musical and legal interpretation. And then I end with a series of brief remarks on how such strategies of the production of originality through othering might be countered in a concept of the commons as being embedded in local moral economies, in which the relationships among subjects and between subjects and objects are forever fluctuating and following a logic that is not driven by market factors alone. First, music and the law. Let me then, to begin, introduce some of the key players in this story, starting perhaps with Owen Dean, the aforementioned lawyer who led the litigation against Disney. Dean is the CEO and partner of the South African law firm Spoor and Fisher, which specializes in patents, trademarks, and copyright. At the heart of what Dean called the propaganda campaign against Disney was the attempt to portray Disney's infringement as a premeditated affront to South African national pride by a company famous for its blatant disregard for inalienable cultural heritage. Witness Disney's stunning feat of having secured patent rights for Snow White, among other staples within the public domain. Disney's stance, it ought to be mentioned, stands in marked contrast to Gallo, the record company that produced Mbube in 1939, for a long time owned the copyright to it through various subsidiaries, and until around 1987 has shown little interest in protecting even its own property. In the wake of Paul Simon's historic Graceland recording, however, and of South Africa's transition to majority rule, Gallo refurbished its image from that of a bastion of cultural segregation to an African company out to conquer larger markets beyond the African continent's southern tip. Gallo, along with the South African Department of Cultural Affairs, funded the lawsuit and negotiated the building of a Linda Memorial. Another major protagonist, although he was not himself part of the legal proceedings, is Rian Malan, a South African journalist. In the mid-80s, Milan had caused a stir with his award-winning book, My Traitor's Heart, a wrenching story about the hardships of ordinary and some not-so-ordinary people living under apartheid. Working along similar lines, Milan in 2004 published a story in the Rolling Stone magazine entitled In the Jungle, Who Owns the Lion Sleeps Tonight? And in which he charted the trajectory of Mbube from, in his words, a South African ditty to one of the most profitable songs in the history of recorded sound. It was Milan's piece that provided much of the ammunition for Dean's propaganda campaign. Two, law as culture. A key distinction characterizing liberal legal thought from John Locke down to the present is that between subject and object. Under the liberal legal gaze, the world is filled with objects which exist independently of the mind and whose properties and relations can be appropriated through labor and as such can be exchanged among subjects on the basis of contractual agreements. Of course, such an objectivist understanding precludes any notion that not only are such objects the products of socially hegemonic classifications and structures of meaning. Equally incompatible is the notion of the liberal legal subject with post-structural concepts of the subject as, to use the well-worn phrase, discursive products. The result, in other words, of specific historical, geographical, and cultural systems of signification based on language, religion, art, and increasingly commodities functioning as signs. Intellectual property law refuses to take into account such cultural contingencies. An author is simply an individual who first copyrighted a work. Originality does not mean that the work is authentic, but merely denotes the fact that nobody else can claim having originated the work, and so on. Thus, one of the first tasks in examining intellectual property legal universalism is to ask whether Solomon Linda was a subject in the sense of the liberal premise of intellectual property law and the action brought against Disney. Although the legal and political agency of black South African artists in 1939 was severely restricted and many musicians signed away the rights to their works under dubious circumstances, Dean's strategy is interesting because many of the arguments advanced in support of Linda's estate claims subliminally question Linda's status as an originator. By mixing the seemingly natural, neutral image of the originator with a series of polysemantic, romantic, and orientalizing concepts, Dean attributes to Linda qualities that stand in marked contrast to those of the autonomous legal subject of the Anglo-American tradition, and run the risk of undermining the broader intentions foregrounded in Dean's propaganda campaign. As I've said, the key elements of this campaign were first mapped out in Milan's article, In the Jungle. In it, Milan bestowed on Linda the image of a natural-born genius, and in evoking pity with him, draws on a well-established colonial trope of what François Bayard in The State in Africa, The Politics of the Belly, has called Africa under the yoke. Although Milan portrays performers such as Linda as helpless victims of a ruthless system, these performers are at the same time doubly demeaned through a strategy of othering. Here's an extended excerpt from Milan's article in the Jungle. This is an African yarn, which begins in the loneliest outposts of civilization. One such place is Gordon Memorial School, perched on the rim of a wild valley called Msinga, which lies in the Zulu heartland, about 300 miles southeast of Johannesburg. Among the half-naked herd boys who drift through the mission is a rangy kid called Solomon Linda, born 1909. He and his friends sing at weddings and feasts. In the mid-30s, they shake off the dust and cow shit and take the train to Johannesburg, city of gold, where they move into the slums and become kitchen boys and factory hands. Life is initially very perplexing. Solly keeps his eyes open and transmutes what he sees into songs that he and his homeboys perform a cappella on weekends. He has songs about work, songs about crime, songs about how banks rob you by giving you paper in exchange for real money, songs about how rudely the whites treat you when you go to get your passport. People like the music. Solly and his friends develop a following. Within 2 years, they turn themselves into a very cool urban act that wears pinstripe suits, bowler hats, and dandy two-tone shoes. They become Solomon Linda and the Evening Birds, inventors of a music that will later become known as Tatamia, arising from the warning cry, Totozan Bafana, tread carefully, boys. The Evening Birds were spotted by a talent scout in 1938 and taken to the top of an office building in downtown Joburg. Solomon Linda and the Evening Birds cut several songs, but the one we're interested in was called Mbube. It was a simple three-chord ditty with lyrics something along the lines of, Lion, ha, you are a lion. Inspired by an incident in the Birds' collective Zulu boyhood when they chased lions that were stalking their father's cattle. The first take was a dud, as was the second. The third take almost collapsed at the outset as the unrehearsed musicians dithered and fished for the key. But once they started cooking, the sound was glory bound. Bube wasn't the most remarkable tune, but there was something terribly compelling about the underlying chant, a dense meshing of low male voices above which Solomon yodeled and howled for two exhilarating minutes, occasionally making it up as he went along. The third take was the great one, but it achieved immortality only in its dying seconds when Solly took a deep breath, opened his mouth, and improvised the melody that the world now associates with these words, In the jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. All right. Yarn indeed. Milan's othering of Linda rests on a number of well-worn stereotypes about migrant laborers, Zululand, and African music. Thus, the Msinga area is described as wild and a lonely outpost of civilization, and not as a dumping ground for migrant labor, a product that is of a wild system of exploitation and as such integral to its operation. Meanwhile, the music too is of glorious rawness with its rocking and sound, simple and improvised melody. It is the work of unrehearsed musicians. Of course, as even a casual glance at Linda's recording shows, or listen to Linda's recording, I should say, the original Mbube is a far cry from either of those stereotypes. The distribution of the vocal parts is a case in point. There are four parts called soprano, alta, tenor, and bass. The soprano part is sung by the leader, in this case Linda himself, while alto and tenor are sung by one singer each. The bass part is taken by the remaining singers and consists of a fairly busy ostinato pattern whose strong triadic structure suggests the harmonic framework of the song. What is remarkable here is that this setup very neatly reflects the kind of dairy singing that was being taught by Stern missionaries at Gordon Memorial School. Buba choirs, from the outset, have been modeled on Western mixed choirs, soprano and alta, substituting the female voice parts that were lacking in the all-male environment of migrant labor compounds. But this act of mimesis was mediated by a complex set of connotation based on migrant performers' conception of Western music as an articulated whole of performance style, aesthetics, and social practice. For instance, a synonym for bass, the bass part, is doshaba, those who sing the do. In calling themselves doshaba, these singers explicitly link the organizational structure required with the idea of tonic solfa, based Western tonality, and not to an authentic Zulu core. Elsewhere in his piece, Milan attributes to Linda's composition a subversively rhythmic intensity, a feature he claims to have been introduced to South Africa by African-American performers such as Orpheus McAdoo and his Virginia Vaudeville Company in the late 19th century. Of course, the notion of African-American music as subversive and as being of rhythmic intensity is also a well-worn racial stereotype. But to hear the Orpheus-inspired syncopation thing, as Milan calls it, in Linda's Mbube is completely erroneous. As a quick look, or maybe again, listen, to the responsorial relationship between the chorus and the leader shows. What is striking here is the absence of non-simultaneous entry of the vocal parts, one of the main principles of Zulu vocal polyphony. The fit between the solo vocal line and the chorus is so tight and fixed that it is impossible to consider the synchronism as the complete overlap of call and response. The reason for this lack of the Orpheus-inspired syncopation thing is that the lead singer's part, in the terms of Western functional harmony, is contingent on the chord progression of the chorus. Throughout the 17 cycles, the beginning of Linda's solo phrases always coincide with the first note of the choral response, and in all cases, it is the tonic that is being stated in all parts. What about unrehearsed musicians and improvisation? The regularity exhibited by the responsorial structure moving in synchrony with the basic harmonic framework is enhanced by the pairing of basic phrases and their syntactic arrangement in an overall symmetry. For instance, each cycle consists of four bars, and each bar contains only one chord. Moreover, two of the three melodic patterns sung by the lead singer are grouped in strict binary fashion. Clearly, Linda's Mbube is anything but raw, spontaneous, subversive, or for that matter, African. Instead, the song represents a carefully rehearsed and shrewdly calculated effort that mobilizes a whole range of Western techniques as a way of working through the complex experience of moving in and out of multiple social contexts and identities. Linda's Mbube addresses the conflicting strands of the migrant experience in ways that are located within its very syntax, and more importantly, perhaps, in the performative chain of signifiers it brings to the fore. This is why Rian Malan's authentication of Linda, well-intentioned though it may be, deprives Solomon Linda of his agency in shaping the terms of engagement with the global music industry from a distinct, albeit vastly disadvantaged, position. Third, music as law. Scholars of African-American performance have long insisted that such strategies of signification in which the subject is constantly evading the fixity and stability of the transcendental ego of enlightened rationality are crucial for those living in the shadow of modernity. They have taken to heart Michel Foucault's reminder that, quote, the author is not an indefinite source of significations which fill a work. He is a certain functional principle by which, in our culture, one limits, excludes, and chooses. In short, by which one impedes the free circulation of fiction. In fact, if we are accustomed to presenting the author as a genius, as a perpetual surging of invention, it is because, in reality, we make him function in exactly the opposite fashion. Unquote. By highlighting the alternative forms of identity embedded in and enabled by many forms of Black creativity, these scholars have underscored the power of these creative practices to transform the very conditions under which they are being produced. Hence, one might argue, casting Solomon Linda as an unrecognized African hero, unrehearsed, improvising natural genius, or for that matter, as property holder, is a form of counterfeit, which imputes the unity of the enlightened liberal subject to more fluid, alternative ways of grounding subjectivity in non-possessive forms of creativity. Why counterfeit and not plain theft? Counterfeit, I suggest, is a form of appropriation that is situated between theft and forgery in the more conventional meaning applied, say, to artworks. It is a useful term for some of the assumptions governing intellectual property legislation because, unlike theft, which cuts off any relation with the original owner, counterfeit at times maintains a link, if not to the owner, to the original. At times it even openly advertises indebtedness to an original. Counterfeit then, one might say, presupposes some form of exchange, a circular movement in which objects do not simply change hands by violent means. It hopes for tacit recognition, the acknowledgement, however mistaken, that which has been returned is the real thing. In this sense, I would suggest, beyond depriving the Linda family of millions of dollars in earnings, counterfeit is actually one of the key forms of cross-cultural interaction, whether it takes the form of covers, such as The Lion Sleeps Tonight, or by imposing universal legal concepts, as, for instance, in the conflation of originality with ownership, so fundamental to the Anglo-American tradition. It is therefore open to question whether by acknowledging that reversionary interest fell to the Linda heirs, the court did more than establish the ownership in Bulba. It, in fact, returned something to Linda, the individual, that was not part of his identity from the beginning. This returning of an original and an originator to where they have not been any is well known to those familiar with the early history of American popular music, especially the roots of Tin Pan Alley in the blackface minstrel stage. As Eric Lott's incisive discussion in Love and Theft of mid-19th century minstrel shows illustrates, the willed attempts by white performers in blackface to approximate the effects found in slave songs are more than handicraft devices deployed by the burgeoning music industry to disguise the alienated character of its product. In many ways, as one of the earliest models for normative musical production, minstrelsy also was a key factor in disseminating into the wider cultural sphere the notion of the musical commodity as a repository in reflection of authentic experience. 19th century blackface minstrelsy is also the model for the counterfeit at the heart of The Lion Sleeps Tonight, the Tolkien's cover of Linda's Mbube, and as such, the basis for the soundtrack of The Lion King. For if, as Lott says, minstrel music amounted to a plundering of black music and its outcome involved a, quote, wink at the counterfeit alongside a nod toward blackness, much the same strategy underpins the claim that Linda is the composer of The Lion Sleeps Tonight. For instance, while technically the drum triplets that you may have heard and the shouts, might be said to be a Tin Pan Alley handicraft, and as such not present in the 1939 recording, they also veil the deadly monotony of the cover by suggesting emotional spontaneity and rhythmic complexity as key markers of African identity. They are indeed false currency, counterfeit money. Or as Carol Clover puts it in a parallel discussion of white appropriation of black dance in film, they are, quote, the memories that surface in the process of forgetting, as though in a perverse bargain they must be admitted in order to be overridden, unquote. In the same breath as the drum triplets and the hop-hop shouts remember the folk origins of Mbube, they forget them. Drums and wild cries pretend to restore in a token act of equal exchange to the original an authenticity they denied to it by theft in the first place. Four, music and the commons. Earlier, I mentioned that one of the crucial distinctions at the heart of the liberal premise of intellectual property law is that between subject and object. Parallel to my discussion of the construction of the composer, of the composer Linda as property holder, I will suggest that the status of his song Bube as his inalienable property does not only derive from the British Imperial Copyright Act of 1911, and liberal tradition more generally, but from the growing leverage intellectual property law, corporate power, and, regrettably, certain forms of liberal discourse increasingly wield over the right to define what counts as an object in the first place. Much of this leverage resides in legal language itself. Thus, the very word substantial, which is usually invoked in cases like these where the task is to establish a substantial similarity. The very word substantial connotes property. Derived from the Latin substare, to base on, to be fundamental, the substance of an idea is that which can be owned about it. With regard to music, copyright law for the past 150 years or so has understood such ownable substance to be mainly the melody and lyrics of a song. It only takes a superficial knowledge of modern compositional techniques, of course, to become aware of the inadequacy of this notion. Sampling-based genres, such as hip-hop, for instance, clearly do not fundamentally involve larger melodic units or chord progressions. But as the very term sampling suggests, minute and more often than not, imperceptible fragments called beats. Maybe I'm preaching to the choir here a little bit. The appropriation of such fragments and their insertion into new compositions at the hands of superstars consequently often become acts of open defiance of a law considered to be detrimental to artistic innovation, such as when Puff Diddy famously and ostentatiously paid a large sum of money for using certain beats as a means for displaying his wealth. So what then is the substance of a song like Bube, and how is such substance either being normalized or erased as locally meaningful by intellectual property law? My earlier discussion of the structure of Bube suggests that while on one level some of the song's features support the notion of the song being the result of an individual act of creativity rather than of an impromptu collective performance, on another level, the song plays with authenticity, or what Malan calls primitive bawling, in an effort to disrupt stable identities. Of course, this conclusion itself is the outcome of a certain analytic privileging of the very parameters that also define music's objecthood in intellectual property law terms, parameters like melody, lyrics, and harmony. On the other hand, in interviews with Gilbert Madondo, the only surviving member of Linda's group, The Evening Birds, and other veterans performers of the 1930s and 40s that I conducted in the 1980s, melody rarely, if ever, figured. For the most part, the discussions about composer, styles, and performance practices of early Mbube referred to individual songs through the polysemic term ingoma, and more generally revolved around things like texture, vocal parts, dance, and dress codes as distinguishing marks, as substance, in other words, of a song or repertoire. There thus appears to be little precedent in Bube for the notion inherent in copyright of melody and lyrics as the substance of a song. But at the same time, Bube's eschewing of Western liberal conceptions of objecthood does not mean that Bube choirs lack clear ideas about the ownership of their songs. As the following line from a song by the King Boys, recorded in 1984, suggests, "We're going to Sabantu in Pietermaritzburg. They say that there are some cowards to sing our songs." Or, in this song, by the New Home Brothers, recorded around the same time, "What is this that I'm hearing? What are these people doing? Why are they imitating my songs? Arrest them, handcuff them. Hey, take no note of them. They are novices trying to copy from me. We dislike what you're doing. Don't use our name in trying to win girls." Even though using another choir song here is criticized as an act of misappropriation, the offense does not so much consist in its unilaterality, any less than it necessarily suggests a superior position on the part of those committing the offense. Rather, it is understood as a sign of weakness. Power inheres in songs themselves, and not merely in their rendering. That is why stealing songs, even while it enhances choirs' chances of defeating competing choirs by turning, as it were, their own weapons against them, reveals a choir's cowardice and lack of power. In this sense, Mbube songs are not objects whose relationships to subjects can be reduced to that of an exclusive property, as much as their practices that involve melodies among other things. And who can own a practice? Another example of the fluid, non-commodified, non-objective nature of Mbube songs are the choral associations that have sprung up throughout South Africa from the 1960s and 1970s. Faced with a steady decline of Mbube's market appeal and media presence, Mbube choirs, in an effort to protect their creative efforts, formed associations whose main purpose is the organization of weekly competitions. The constant circulation of cash is a prominent feature of these events, structuring them in ways that do not necessarily imply property relations. For instance, all member choirs pay monthly dues, while audiences may pay small entrance fees. In addition, each choir pays a so-called request fee for the moment of time it is on stage, while competing choirs and their fans are allowed to buy off the choir from the stage to make room for another choir. At the end of the competition, all monies collected will be redistributed in the form of cash prizes and sometimes as stipends to choir members in need. Another feature that underscores the deliberately anti-commercial nature of choir association is their roots in the diffusion of intra-ethnic tensions among migrant laborers by means of competitive performance. As I've shown elsewhere, early Mbube competitions were modeled on contests of stick fighting, which have been taking place in rural areas from as early as the 1920s. Pitting against each other teams of youth from a certain area, these stick fights were ritualized expressions of conflicts among dispossessed clan members over access to labor and land formerly considered as tribal lands and later confiscated by white farmers under the Native Land Act of 1913. Unlike the so-called faction fights periodically erupting in these areas, stick fights were nonviolent and meant to foster group cohesion while at the same time imposing a modicum at least of inter-clan respect. In short, Mbube songs are less prized for their exchange value than as conduits for maintaining social relations governed by the appropriation of use value within the broader framework of a moral economy aimed at solidarity and ritualized conflict resolution. And I come to an end. The story of Mbube and the Lion King does not end with the settlement. Numerous blogs have sprung up around it, and even the descendants of The Lion Sleeps Tonight, co-owner George Wise, and some of the Tokens band members have joined the fray, demanding a share of the cake. But perhaps it is Owen Dean and composer Chipembere who have best grasped the momentous implications of the case. Because The Lion Sleeps Tonight is arguably an element of South African culture, Dean, for instance, points out, the settlement is of, quote, particular importance to the heirs of South African authors who suffered legal and commercial disabilities under the apartheid system, unquote. While undoubtedly true, Dean's conclusion adds an additional, utterly mind-boggling dimension to the settlement. A parallel, he asserts, quote, can be drawn between the descendants of authors of copyright works relying upon the reversionary interest and land claims perused by persons whose forebears had suffered injustice through their land being misappropriated. The flip side of the millennial redistribution of wealth is, of course, risk. Neoliberalism's and indeed intellectual property law's most fundamental assumption that entrepreneurship deserves to be rewarded precisely because it entails risk. Thus, I think that Chipembere is right on the mark with his conclusion that while the Mbube case clearly demonstrates the fact that, quote, anybody can bring up a lawsuit, the question is, will they win? But perhaps the final word in this saga should go to Solomon Linda himself. The notion that counterfeit was an integral part of the migrant experience was deeply etched into his consciousness. Contrary to the image of the country bumpkin, Linda, sometime in the late 1940s, composed a song about counterfeit money. They have taken my money, the song goes, and given me paper instead. Thank you.